The only proof I offer of these reflections here is the great cry of deliverance and blessing that echoes in the brilliant lines of Claude's Magnificat, probably the most beautiful hymn to paternity ever written. Now between me and other men there is this difference: I am a father of one of them. But there is no necessity to exalt the nobility and the value of fruitfulness for Christians. Neither sarcasms nor the superior smiles of the skeptical can shake their conviction. They have measured the gift of God and wish only to return that gift. We can take it for granted that every Christian home is ready to welcome children. But how many? On this point all the difficulties begin. The virtue of abandon. As many as you can, say the intrepid. Not to have the greatest number of children destined to eternal happiness is to limit God's glory. Such is at least the simplest theoretical justification of the partisans of fruitfulness without limit. But it is a fragile argument. In spite of its mystical character, it is puerile because it brings the rules of geometry and arithmetic into a domain where all human calculations are mysteriously transcended. Indeed, it would soon become inhuman if one were to draw the conclusion that the survival of a child mattered little so long as it received baptism. It is difficult enough to maintain level-headedness in discussion without taking pleasure in embarrassing our partner or driving him to the wall of contradiction or fanaticism. Large families are not based upon so poor a mixture of mathematics and mysticism. In fact, they are usually found among those who are least calculating. In the final analysis, they are based on one of the most beautiful of all Christian virtues, abandon, hope. Those who have seen such families need no convincing, and others will have no trouble imagining, that abandon to providence is necessary. And by that we do mean something other than lifeless fatalism or foolish presumption. We are speaking of clear-headed heroism that takes the promises of our Lord literally. Sufficient for the day is the evil thereof. Behold the lilies of the field. Henceforward we can bid adieu to long, drawn-out plans, complacent comfort and smug satisfaction with ourselves. We are pledged to a fife of sacrifice and denudation, at least of spiritual denudation. We must simplify everything, even our souls, but this poverty, from other points of view, enriches. We gain, for example, energy and ingenuity. We become like smiling warriors, ever ready to do battle with the enemy. And in our warfare we begin to experience tangible aid from above. Divine prodigality follows upon human generosity. If such families fulfill a certain Christian ideal, there remain nevertheless several ways of understanding and of carrying out the responsibilities of marriage within the same vocation. Numerous options are still possible. Ambiguity of a large family. Before being a hero, many esteem a father of 12 children a symbolical number, to be a privileged character. He must command, if not a large income, at least considerable resources. He must have a place to house all of his children. He must be free from material restraint. God never abandons his children, some say. The father of 12 children is above all a man of faith, say others. We can agree with this, although it is always dangerous to speculate on divine providence. God is not a kind of ingenious captain who automatically stops up all leakages in our ship. Providence lets the victims of a shipwreck save themselves. We must distinguish here between lack of foresight and the sin of imprudence and frivolity. If a father of 12 is privileged, it is above all because he has met a valiant woman. In this matter, we have every right to center consideration upon mothers. The physical and moral strength, the resources of spirit and heart, the virtues of abnegation and adaptability necessary to a mother of 12 are beyond calculation. It is impossible to measure the number of sacrifices she consents to make. We can leave aside for the moment the heroic patience demanded by so many months, even years, of pregnancy and think of the accumulation of responsibilities, the affectionate and inexorable tyranny imposed by so many children. Give this mother all the domestic aid you please, Still, she will have very little time to think of herself, of her mind, her culture, or her personal development. Many will retort that culture has no place in a mother's life. The constant exercise, they say, of her maternal obligations is the real mission and consequently the only happiness for woman. Thus we see her consecrated to the heartless wear and tear of a difficult vocation and premature exhaustion. But let us not be deceived by fine phrases. Few women are disposed to accept with gaiety of heart, with all the serenity of a reasoned and free commitment, such a program of life. Many of them do not have the necessary health. Still others are not prepared by their education, or by the environment in which they grew up, to understand the natural and supernatural beauty of this kind of heroism. There are any number of other conditions of mind and heart that a mother must also fulfill. We may well ask whether they are fulfilled, even by those who, in point of fact, have fewer children. This opens up a new problem. It is one thing to want many children, quite another to submit to having them. This sort of fruitfulness is at best second best. Many women make this submission either because they do not wish to violate the commandment of God or perhaps because they do not wish to refuse their husband. Their dedication conserves something of its grandeur. Nevertheless, it is difficult to esteem a hero, a man who does not know how or does not wish to practice restraint, difficult to consider the home a model in which the joy of one partner is the terror of the other. Of course, no one has the power of judging from the outside the secrets of hearts or the motives behind actions. Yet in many cases the beauty of a large family appears a little disconcerting to outsiders. The very real danger exists, for the man at least, that a way of itself onerous may become an easy way. And here we must declare that something is to be said for conjugal chastity. It, too, is legitimate and heroic in its own right. Supernatural prudence. We do not have to consider the inhumanity of the world in which we live very long to perceive the savagery with which it conspires against the family. Many young couples living in apartments simply do not have room for children. Or if they have the good fortune of a large home, the high cost of living and constant threat of inflation militates against their good intentions. It is a fact that today a large number of homes, especially urban homes, cannot possibly welcome too many children. Then there is the perennial question of health. Many women worn out by frequent pregnancies aspire in vain to regain their strength. It is therefore evident that there are cases, today more numerous than ever, where, in the name of human prudence, couples must space their children, and in some cases, cease having them altogether. And supernatural prudence will ratify these decisions, provided the parents are perfectly loyal to their conscience. If we sincerely believe, after reasoned examination and thought, that a new child will endanger the equilibrium of a home, I am using the word in its most human and profound sense, and not in a contemptible financial sense, then it is the role of Christian virtue to safeguard that equilibrium. Would this be to open the doors to a masked egoism, to the desire for spiritual comfort, or to God only knows what self-indulging pretension for human respect? Undoubtedly that danger exists. It is always easy to shuffle off our responsibilities under the pretense of impossibility. Egoism uses subtle camouflages. But this illusion is only a danger and not a rule. And it can be avoided once the home has reached a certain maturity of spirituality. Everything depends upon the human and spiritual efforts that have already been made, upon how genuine the proofs of our generosity have been in the past. Prudence as a supernatural virtue can be exercised only if it is enlightened and sustained by all the other virtues. I believe that once a certain degree of spirituality has been attained in a life penetrated by prayer and illumined by faith, when we know how to ask for grace with humility, then we can hope to avoid crass errors of judgment and the craftily laid traps of laziness and Pharisaism. Then there is place for continence. The golden rule is to be sincere with oneself, with our partner, and to make all decisions together. There is great beauty in the efforts of two people not to be dominated by animal instinct, not to consent to an act whose consequences they no longer desire, to keep well under control the course of their lives. They cannot be charged with egoistic calculation. On the contrary, this conjugal chastity is so difficult that it requires ceaseless struggling, suffering and, indeed, heroism. The limits of this article do not permit me to go into this problem that is so crucial in many homes. I merely wish to point out that conjugal chastity comports two degrees, absolute continence or that of long duration and, second, periodic continence based on the Agena method. All calculations here remain hazardous since the physiological laws in this domain are capricious. Those who attempt it with sufficiently justified motives can be given credit for their goodwill and at least elementary prudence. But in a Christian heart, one virtue does not exclude another. If, in spite of these efforts, a child is conceived, the problem changes. Better still, the problem disappears altogether. The prudence exercised by the parents could easily take on the gloomy and petty countenance of regret if they did not welcome the unexpected child without hesitation or reserve, with the same fervor and the same manifestation of joy as they welcomed the others. They must ask God, with hope and filial fear, for the strength and grace they need to bear this additional burden. Thus it is a choice between two heroisms, the heroism of continence or the heroism of grateful acceptance. This is not merely a theoretical juggling of words, or an attempt to find a loophole in the law of God. Rather, it is a hard reality dictated by the circumstances of the modern family. Perhaps we can affirm without paradox that prudence calls forth generosity and, far from setting itself up against other virtues, is maintained and supported by them. In any case, conjugal chastity must serve to promote love. It can succeed only if it dilates the personality instead of imposing restrictions upon it. There is a danger that must constantly be resisted of becoming obsessed with the privations we suffer and thence of falling into a kind of cantankerous stoicism. We must recall that love is not restricted to a physical gift. Nor is fruitfulness only of the body. A father and mother are never through giving life to their children. If they must renounce calling new children into existence, they are then freer to give more attention to those they already have. They must try to understand better their ideals and satisfy better the needs of their minds and souls. This task of the education of their children is one that is noble enough and complex enough to occupy them totally. It assumes a union between them just as precious as physical union, of which it is after all the consequence. It is the work of a lifetime that elevates their ideals, broadens their horizons and safeguards them from unhappiness. Indeed, there are no limits to this deepening of love, of which the education of children is at once the means and the symbol. Thus, conjugal chastity, provided it brings the parents to a better understanding of the hierarchy of values and enables them to see their lives in a broader perspective, is a source of human progress. But it does not take on its fullest meaning until it is put at the service of a greater love. Necessity of heroism. There are no easy answers to this problem of fruitfulness. There are no pat solutions. Each home must find its own way, often in suffering, and seek out its own manner of joining the necessary generosity with the indispensable prudence. The greatest danger is falsehood, especially the type of self-deception that warps our whole interior life. It gives rise to a certain fatalism or a lack of self-control that can easily be taken for abnegation and faith. In all such falsehood there is a certain faint-hearted egoism that reveals a selfish desire for spiritual consolation. Beneath all of the prevarications there is an element of truth. It can differ in aspect as the multifarious circumstances differ that command individual destinies. But they find a common denominator in this, that they postulate heroism. There is heroism in accepting a large family. There is also heroism in a justified refusal to go beyond an average family. And this heroism is possible only if it is founded on human love and nourished by love of God. It is a heroism that really enlarges the scope of love.